This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Her daughter's account of the last painful days of the actress Diana Rigg prompted another wave of commentary this week about whether the UK should change the law regarding assisted dying. When we first started The Briefing Room over 7 years ago, it was a subject where the lack of evidence meant that we regarded this as a largely ethical or theoretical issue, and not for us. It was one for the moral maze. But things have changed. Specifically, a number of countries have now had assisted dying and euthanasia policies in place for some time, providing some of the evidence that was previously missing. So what does that evidence tell us, and how might we respond to it? Step into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Let's start with some definitions and with establishing what is and isn't legal in the UK. Imogen Gould is Professor of Medical Law at the University of Oxford. Imogen Gould, let's start with some definitions, because a lot of people use some of these terms interchangeably. I think I might even have done so myself. So could you put me straight?
So I think we might talk generally about something called assisted dying. And I think the way to think about that is it's a blanket term for a range of ways in which people might choose to end their lives. Within that, we would talk about assisted suicide. And what we mean by that is where someone is assisted to end their lives themselves. So that might mean giving them some medications that they take themselves that will end their life. Or it might mean things like traveling to a clinic. So helping someone to go to somewhere like Dignitas in Switzerland, where they will be assisted to end their lives as well, by the provision of medications to them. Now, that's quite different from what we mean by euthanasia. The key difference is that euthanasia is where somebody else does the act that causes someone's life to be ended. So that might be a doctor or another person is the person who is doing the thing that causes the death. And even within that, you might split that up into voluntary euthanasia and non-voluntary euthanasia. And voluntary euthanasia is where the person who's going to die makes a conscious, competent decision to die and they ask for someone to help them. Whereas non-voluntary euthanasia is where the decision is taken on their behalf. So they haven't agreed to it, they haven't consented, and it's done potentially against their wishes.
Okay, so that circumstance in which a doctor eases someone out of their life, let's say with a large dose of morphine, if they're suffering a lot of pain, that would come under the category of euthanasia, but usually with some form of consent from the patient.
Yeah, so I think historically in those sorts of cases, part of the problem, of course, is the doctor can't have an open discussion with someone about it. But the person might have indicated it to them, they might have told the doctor, but there might also be cases where the doctor believes that that's what the person wants. And that's where it gets very grey.
Right, now, let's look at what the law in the UK currently says. What is the law about this?
So if we divide it into euthanasia and assisted suicide, so if we take euthanasia first, euthanasia is illegal. So it's essentially, it's murder. If a doctor deliberately ends a patient's life, they are potentially guilty of murder. So they've done the act, they've done the thing that's ended the life, and they've got the intention to end their life. So that is completely illegal, and that's been confirmed in a number of cases. So it's a very clear position. If we take assisted suicide, so suicide itself has ceased to be a crime. So the Suicide Act of 1961, whereas the act of encouraging someone or assisting them to die by suicide is still a crime.
Now, what does the law therefore permit? I mean, you've said the law does not permit euthanasia of any kind, but one kind of euthanasia was the sort we were talking about, which is essentially doctors helping somebody in a lot of pain to die.
So there's a range of things. One is the person who is dying can simply refuse treatment. So somebody might say, I just don't want to have any more chemo. I don't want to take the medications that might prolong my life. And they essentially opt out of treatment and they let the condition, the underlying condition, take its course and that will end their life. People can also refuse nutrition and hydration. So they can say, I don't want any more food and hydration, and that will end their life. And also treatment can be withdrawn. So doctors don't have to give treatment to people if they think that it's futile. And that can happen when the person is competent, but it can also happen when the person is incompetent and can't make their own decision. There have been quite a long series of challenges, and these have been via both measures to change the law legislatively, so challenges in Parliament through a series of bills, and all of those have failed. Some have got quite a long way through the process, but they've all ultimately failed. And there's also been a series of cases in which people have challenged the law. And those are often framed by trying to argue, like in the Pretty case, that the right to life really includes a right to die and that you should have a choice about your life and that that choice should include how you end your life. And in the case of Purdy, where what Debbie Purdy was looking for was trying to get some clarity about when the Director of Public Prosecutions would or wouldn't prosecute someone for assisting a death. And the reason that was brought is because it was clear that even though people were assisting people to die, so assisting them to go to places like Dignitas in Switzerland, that the Director of Public Prosecutions wasn't actually prosecuting them.
Now, that's very interesting because that almost suggests that the Director of Public Prosecutions was invited to make the law on what was permitted with regard to assisted dying.
Yeah, so the difficulty with Purdy was what she wanted was to be assisted to die, so she wanted to be helped to go to Switzerland. But her concern was that if her partner helped her do that, that when he returned back to England, he'd face a prosecution for assisting her. And what she wanted was clarity. And the Director of Public Prosecutions didn't want to give clarity, that pressure essentially was put on him.
It seems rather remarkable that the law hadn't made it clear.
Well, the DPP always has discretion about when to prosecute. And so essentially his argument was, well, I don't want to bind myself by telling you what my future decisions will be. But in the end, what did happen was he produced guidance, not definitive guidance, but guidance that would say these are the sorts of factors that would increase the likelihood of prosecution.
I think it would be fun for you to remind us who the DPP was at this point.
The DPP at that time was Keir Starmer.
Right. And has that guidance been regarded as being useful?
I think that it is useful in some ways because it's not entirely clear, but that was the goal. It was not going to be definitive. It doesn't give you a complete answer. But if you look at the sorts of factors that are in that guidance, they are things like, was the suspect unknown to the victim? Was the suspect paid? Was the suspect acting in a context where this is going to be done publicly? So what they're looking for is things that suggest that the ending of life, the assistance, wasn't driven by compassion.
Imogen Gould, before we take a look at the experience of countries where assisted dying has been allowed for some time, let's now try and frame the state of debate here in Britain, which will help us to assess what has happened abroad. Richard Huxtable is Professor of Medical Ethics and Law at the University of Bristol. Richard Huxtable, we've heard that there's a long history of trying to get assisted dying made legal in the UK. Where are we right now with that in Westminster?
We know that currently the campaign organisation Dignity in Dying is calling on political parties to make time for this discussion so that there can be, they hope, a free vote in the next parliament.
Do we know anything about whether or not the devolved administrations are looking at assisted dying or have been recently in the same way?
So we certainly know that many jurisdictions, legal systems in the UK and nearby have been looking closely at this issue. So most recently, Scotland with Liam MacArthur's bill, they've been exploring the issues. We know that the Isle of Man is coming very close to allowing assisted dying where the individual is terminally ill. And there are also ongoing discussions in Jersey, which has agreed in principle to legalise assisted dying in some form. And that law is currently being drafted and will be debated further in 2024.
Now, if you were summarising this for one of your students, how would you explain why all the attempts to get a bill so far passed have failed?
Well, I think there tend to be three main grounds of opposition to allowing assisted dying. The first, with probably the longest history, is the idea that life itself has value. And we tend to see this expressed particularly by those from various religious faiths, but it can also be a secular position about the right to life. So that's one ground of opposition. Another ground of opposition is concerns, and we hear these discussed a lot more these days, about possible pressure on those who are vulnerable, about the messages we're sending about the value of a life with disability, and risks of abuse. So so-called slippery slope arguments are a big concern. And a third concern tends to come from the medical profession. What will this do to the nature of doctoring or good doctoring? What will it do to relationships between doctors and patients? And indeed, do doctors even express a willingness to perform this if it were to be legal?
Has the views of the medical profession as expressed, let's say, through their associations, evolved at all in recent years?
So traditionally, it's fair to say that the medical profession at large and professional medical organisations have been opposed to allowing assisted dying. But we're seeing the position change in recent years. For example, in 2020, the Royal College of General Practitioners expressed that it remained opposed to assisted dying, whilst around the same time, in fact in 2021, the Doctors' Trade Union, the British Medical Association, moved to a position of neutrality, so neither officially supporting nor opposing a possible change in the law.
How are you to understand that BMA position? Does it suggest that doctors have become more likely to think that there are circumstances under which they would be prepared to do this?
I think we do encounter split opinion amongst doctors. We know that those most closely involved in care for those people who are dying or approaching death, so in other words, those working in palliative and end-of-life care, they tend on balance to be opposed. But other groups of doctors, we do see expression of support, including a willingness on the behalf of some doctors to perform this if it were to be legal. But for example, the British Medical Association found that the majority of respondents to its consultation, 45%, would not actively participate.
I think now's the moment you can tell us about how public attitudes, as far as we can measure them, to assisted dying have evolved.
So we know that in recent decades, pretty consistently in the UK and indeed quite a few other countries, around about 70 to 80% of the public say they would support allowing assistance in dying, at least in some circumstances. I do have some difficulty, some concerns about some of the surveys. They're sometimes asked in the context of a very high profile and very sensitive and high emotion case. And sometimes there are also what the scientists call framing effects. So the way the questions are asked seem to nudge people to give particular answers. But that said, we must still acknowledge there is still clearly overwhelmingly majority public support.
One of the arguments that you were talking about earlier was the notion that even the availability of assisted dying might seem to pass a judgment on the quality of life of people who were suffering from various conditions. How does that argument work itself out and who makes it?
So amongst the concerns we hear from people with disabilities, for example, is concerns that there might, if we allow assisted dying, there might be real or perceived pressure to take up the option. There might be abuse of any law. And there might also be a signal sent by the law about the value of life with a disability. So Alison Davis herself, who had many disabilities, would strongly write and speak in opposition to allowing this because she was concerned about the arguments involving a deadly mix of emotion, economics, because killing on her account is cheaper than caring, and a negative view of the value of vulnerable people.
I wanted to ask you a slightly different question, Richard, about some of the criteria. And knowing that the terror of my generation, at any rate, is dementia and finding yourself in a situation whereby the quality of life you might have wanted is no longer available to you, it's hard to see how any legislation is going to make it easier in that regard.
That's true. I think if we look to laws internationally, what one tends to see is a law involving one or two eligibility criteria. So in terms of those who would be allowed to be assisted in their deaths. So one set of laws would restrict this to people approaching the end of their lives, so the terminally ill. Another set, and some laws do both of these, but another set would focus not necessarily on terminal illness, but on the presence of unbearable suffering. So as the Dutch ethicist Burr has put it, on the one hand, we might have a law around avoiding or escaping a terrible death, but on the other, we might have a law around avoiding or escaping a terrible life.
Richard Huxtable. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes our episode on Ukraine's second winter of war, the one on whether we are on course for net zero, and the one on what our migration figures really mean. Back to assisted dying and what has actually happened in places where it's legal. Agnes van der Heide is Professor in End-of-Life Care and Decision-Making at the Erasmus University Medical Centre in Rotterdam. And Thaddeus Pope is Professor at the Health Law Institute, Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in Minnesota. So Thaddeus Pope, I believe that the first jurisdiction in the modern world to enact assisted dying legislation was the US state of Oregon. Why did it happen there?
It happened in Oregon in 1994. Because Oregon has a popular ballot initiative, where instead of going through the state legislature, it was able to be voted on by the people themselves. And that area of the country very much wanted medical aid in dying. And so they put it on the ballot and it was enacted.
Who is eligible?
Well, first of all, just to be super clear, in Oregon, what we're talking about is self-administered assisted dying. So the physician's only role is to provide the prescription of lethal medications to the patient, but the patient has to ingest those medications by herself. The patients that are eligible for that are adults who are over 18 years of old, who have decision-making capacity, and terminally ill with a disease that is likely to cause their death within the next 6 months. It's considered to be one of the most restrictive laws in the world because of that 6 month temporal prognosis, and also because the only service that's being offered is self-administration and not clinician administration. So those two things make it very, very restrictive.
Right. We'll come on later to find out who has actually taken it up and the demographics of that. But Agnes van der Heide, as we've already heard in the program, euthanasia is different from assisted dying, whether or not it's a physician administered or self-administered. Now, I believe that the first country to allow that was actually the country you're in, the Netherlands.
Yes, I think that's true.
So who qualifies? And what are the safeguards in the Netherlands?
The law is primarily aimed to support physicians who think that they may need to fulfill a patient's request to have medical assistance in dying. And the law requires physicians to assess whether that request is really well considered and independent, whether patient's assessment that they are suffering unbearably from an incurable illness without prospect of relief, and they also have to guarantee that patients are well informed and that there must be no alternatives to relieve the suffering.
Now, does that definition of unbearable suffering cover only physical diseases, or does it actually extend, or may it ever extend, to mental illnesses?
In principle, mental illness also qualified. There is no specific definition of what the suffering should entail or what the origin of the suffering should be. Case law has learned that there need to be either a medical condition or a psychiatric diagnosis. So there has to be a medical or psychiatric illness, but mental illness indeed in principle qualifies for assistance in dying.
Thaddeus, can we look beyond Oregon and to different states in America? Can you just very briefly tell me what the situation is in those states that are allowing some form of assisted dying?
We allow assisted dying in 11 states, so Oregon plus 10 other jurisdictions. It's very, very similar. So there are actually aren't significant variations from state to state.
How does the law in Canada differ to the Oregon model?
The law in Canada is very, very different. So first of all, it's across the entire country of Canada. It's not just a piece of legislation. The Supreme Court of Canada found that it's a federal constitutional right to assisted dying. And then in terms of what we're talking about, it's assisted dying. It allows both practitioner administration as well as patient self-administration. And finally, it's a very broad, arguably the broadest on earth, scope of eligibility, right? So there's no temporal requirement, 6 months to death, or anything like that. So as long as the person has what's considered to be a grievous and irremediable condition, and that's very broadly defined, and they're a citizen of Canada, they can have access to medical aid in dying.
Right. We've talked now about what the law is in different places. I want to look now at the experience. In other words, who's actually done what and what it's led to. So Thaddeus, how many people use the law in Oregon and other states? And can we say that those figures have gone up or down significantly in the last few years?
So the figures have definitely gone up because people become more familiar with it, more comfortable with it. But the numbers are very, very low. So in California, for example, where 40 million people live, only 1,000 have died from medical aid in dying. So that's less than one half of 1% of all the people that die from medical aid in dying. And you can contrast that with Canada, because California and Canada both have about the same population, 40 million. So while only 1,000 Californians died from medical aid in dying, 13,000 died from medical aid in dying in Canada, right? So same population, but a 13-fold increase. So there it's between 4 and 5%. Of people that die from medical aid in dying in Canada.
Well, we want to dig into that a little bit more in a moment, after we found out from Agnes how that compares to, say, the experience of the Netherlands.
Yeah, we have assessed numbers in the Netherlands since 1990. So we have 30 years of experience now, so also before the law was enforced. And we started with about 2 to 3% of the total numbers of deaths in the Netherlands that were the result of euthanasia, as we call it. So that's about 3 or 4,000 people per year. But our latest research has demonstrated that the number is now about 9,000, which is about 5% of all deaths in the Netherlands. So the number has clearly increased and is still increasing.
Thaddeus, how might we account for the difference between, say, the Netherlands and Oregon? Is it because in Oregon, physicians are not involved and people might prefer them to be involved? It might feel, sounds ridiculous to say this in the case of assisted dying, but it might feel safer.
That's absolutely true. I think that's one of three main factors that would explain the gigantic tenfold difference between Oregon and the Netherlands. So people are doing this, right? They can obviously kill themselves on their own, right? The reason they want to do it with the help of licensed healthcare professionals is to make sure that it's safe and comfortable. And doing it by themselves, as opposed to having clinician administration, there actually is a significant rate of problems, right? Regurgitating the medications, waking back up, having seizures and things like that. So if it were clinician administration, more people might be more comfortable, right? That this will be safe and effective. Also, the second factor would be that, again, it has a much narrower scope of eligibility. You have to be within 6 months of death. Canada and the Netherlands have a far more open scope of eligibility. And then finally, in the United States, remember, we have 56 jurisdictions. Only 11 permit medical aid in dying. And so it still hasn't really been accepted generally in U.S. culture. And I think, therefore, it still has somewhat of a stigma. And that might be a third factor that deters usage here in the United States.
I just have one thought that occurs to me as a result of what you're saying. Is there a large proportion of people who are eligible and are granted permission essentially to take the medication but don't actually go through with it? Do we know what the proportions are?
It's very large. It's between 30 and 40% of people who are qualified, right? And they actually get the prescription, but then they don't ingest, they don't take the drugs. And that's because typically almost all of these people are receiving hospice and palliative care. And basically those patients find that that is completely sufficient to address their physical or existential suffering. And so they had the drugs just in case, right? Just in case their suffering got really, really bad. But thankfully it didn't, right? Now they had the comfort and the peace of mind knowing that those drugs were there should they need them, but in fact, they never actually needed them.
Agnes, can we look now at the demographics of those who actually use the law in the Netherlands and so far as you can generalize in the rest of Europe?
Yes, well, I think for all jurisdictions where this is an option, the proportion of patients with cancer who request medical assistance in dying is relatively large, and also in the Netherlands, in our latest research, about 60% of all patients who receive assistance in dying are patients with incurable cancer. It's also remarkable that it's not the oldest group of people who receive medical assistance in dying, because 70% of all cases, the patient is younger than 80 years. So that means that the number of requests from the oldest old people is relatively small. Further, it's mainly people who are really in the end stage of their disease, because also 60% of people have an expected life expectancy of 1 month or less. So it's mostly people who are really already in the last stage of their illness. And I think a final important characteristic of the practice in the Netherlands, but also in other countries, is that it's mainly practiced by the general practitioner at the patient's home. So it's not really a hospital-based practice or a practice that is very common in nursing homes. It's mostly the general practitioner who provides assistance in dying.
Do we know anything about the socioeconomic status of the people who tend to make use of the law?
Yeah, we have not recent data about that, but I think 10 years ago we looked into that, and there was a slight overrepresentation of people from higher socioeconomic strata. So people who have higher education or a higher income tend to get a little bit more often assistance in dying than people from lower socioeconomic groups.
So, Thaddeus, the same broad question about what's happening in the United States and North America demographically.
Same thing. So what we see in all these states, they give annual reports giving a lot of demographic data on who's using it. So almost always white college educated patients who have significant resources, who are accustomed to being in control. So there was a long time a concern that this would be foisted upon vulnerable populations, you know, lower socioeconomic statuses and minorities. And that's absolutely not true at all. They almost never use this.
I'd like to ask you both a final question. If you could both just imagine a scenario, you're sitting in front of a UK minister and you're briefing them on whether they should have an assisted dying law. They want one, but they say to you, what are the key lessons we should learn from your experience, first in the Netherlands, Agnes, and then in North America, Thaddeus?
Well, I think for the Netherlands, a key characteristic and a key thing during the whole discussion debate about the practice of euthanasia and about having a law and how the law works has been transparency and public control, ensured both by research and by the work of the review committees. And I think that's to a large extent explaining the very broad support in Dutch society for the system we have.
And Thaddeus?
I think the main thing to think about is balancing and calibrating the trade-off between autonomy and safety. What we see, not only in the United States, but around the world, are jurisdictions constantly recalibrating that balance.
Thaddeus Pope there with Agnes van der Heijden. My thanks to them and to Imogen Gould and Richard Huxtable. And my conclusion from this is simply that hearing the evidence has helped me in my thinking about this complex question, and I hope it's helped you too. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight and Alex Lewis. The sound engineer was James Beard, and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
If anyone is an artist in their soul, it's Joni Mitchell.
There are some artists that change music forever.
The mastery of the guitar, the mastery of voice, the mastery of language.
That shape the musical landscape for everyone who comes after.
When the dust settles, Joni Mitchell may stand as the most important and influential female recording artist of the late 20th century.
Legend is a music biography podcast from BBC Radio 4 that explores the extraordinary lives of musical pioneers.
I think people would like me to just be introverted and bleed for them forever.
Legend, the Joni Mitchell story, with me, Jessica Hoop. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.